Hello and welcome to the EMJ podcast with me, your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. Today I'm joined by Sophia Mareva, Greater Good Breast Cancer Research Professor and Director of the Breast and Ovarian Cancer Risk Evaluation Program at Michigan Medicine. And this is going to be the first in a fascinating two-part episode. After becoming interested in medicine from a young age, Sophia received a doctoral degree in physics from the University of Maryland in Baltimore, Maryland, USA, and a medical degree from the University of Michigan. Sophia then went on to complete her residency in internal medicine, along with a fellowship in oncology, also at the University of Michigan. After joining the faculty at the University of Michigan in 1994, Sophia founded the Breast and Ovarian Cancer Risk Evaluation Program at the Rogel Cancer Center. Additionally, Sophia acts as Scientific Director of the Breast Oncology Program, focusing on clinical translational research that tests molecular, engineering, and educational interventions for cancer patients. From 2010 to 2013, she also served as director of the University of Michigan Center for Global Health, a university-wide cross-disciplinary global health translational research project to ameliorate health disparities in the United States and, in fact, globally. Sophia's multidisciplinary work on the fundamental structure of information transmission in cellular signal transduction cascades brings together groundbreaking work in the fields of oncology, physics, electrical engineering, and cell biology, and as a result, has made waves in cancer research. As a result of her work in 2021, Sophia was elected a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, no mean feat. Alongside her impressive career in academia and clinical trials, Sophia enjoys literature, music, and outdoor activities with her family. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Sophia Mareva. It's an honor to have you here with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So it's apparent that you were scientifically inclined from a very young age, your first degree in physics, for instance. What took you into medicine, and then what drew you to work in breast and ovarian cancer? I love background stories.
Yes, thank you for asking, because it has been a very important part of my journey. For reasons I don't quite, know, from a very young age, I conceived that there was a lot of human suffering due to diseases. And I imagined myself an agent of ameliorating that suffering through science. I don't know how I came to that conclusion. And then within science, I further decided that one needed to have a very basic understanding of all the laws of physics to understand biology. So without revealing too much about myself, that was a long time ago before anybody really was much talking about multidisciplinary work in medicine, especially in the exact sciences. So I guess I take credit for having figured that out when I was a child. And then after training in physics, it became clear that that was not enough to make an impact. I was much older by then, so a little more realistic. And so I figured I'll just go and get my training in medicine. So I went back to the back of the line and started again.
And you have a personal stake in this area. Would you like to share your story with the listeners?
Sure. Well, my first take came from my father's lung cancer when I was a teenager. He was a chain smoker, and I appreciated how little we knew about why smoking caused lung cancer, and even less about how to treat lung cancer. And it would be another 40 years before we would start making major inroads into the treatment of lung cancer. Now, I have had cancer myself, breast cancer, in both breasts. And so I experienced a lot of the events that my patients for many years were going through that I was helping them with. So I got to live it myself.
Right. So that takes me on to my next question. I saw a video online where you talked about not being your own doctor. So often, you know, physicians do go down that path, you know, physician heal thyself and all that. So can you tell us about that element of your treatment, not being a doctor? I mean, I've certainly experienced with family members and saying, look, I want to be your, you know, a member of your family. I don't want to be your doctor. So, yes, tell us about that.
Well, yeah, thank you for asking that, because that is a really, I think, important to disseminate the fact that we as doctors really owe it to our family and friends to be helpful and supportive as friends or as family, not as their doctors. And so I apply that to myself. For me, it was very easy because I am surrounded by brilliant minds in medicine. I pretty much thought that I wouldn't be the best patient. So I tend to not necessarily follow directions all that well sometimes. And so I thought it was even more important, and my family insisted that I very quickly recognize who's going to lead my treatments. And so I did that right away. And I very strongly advise all of our professionals, nurses, physician assistants. It isn't just doctors that are not particularly good at that. So.
Yeah, I know that when I've had the privilege of looking after colleagues in my hospital, and they would turn up with, you know, reams of notes. Well, have you seen this paper? And what do you think about that perspective? You know, so yeah. It can be a challenge. So let's talk a bit about your research interest in molecular genetics in breast cancer. You were involved in a study to identify genes in inflammatory breast cancer. Can you tell us about that work, please? And just as a heads up, although the majority of our audience are healthcare professionals, we do have interested lay people listening in, citizen scientists, if you will. So maybe start at the very beginning and then expand into the details.
Yeah, so inflammatory breast cancer is, I would think, the most aggressive cancer there is, at all comers. So that's a fact that's seldom recognized. People will not survive even 6 months if they are not treated in a timely fashion. And it has been a theme of my thinking about medicine that I always like to tackle what I consider the most pressing need and the hardest problems, a combination of the two. I like hard problems, and so I'm attracted to them. And so very early on, when I recognized listening to patients, that they would explain the following. They would say, they would come to the clinic with a red breast, and then they would say, I went to sleep, and then I woke up, and I had a new red spot high on my armpit or on the top of the front of my arm, and I think that's cancer. And I would hear the patient say that, and then I would go back and talk to my attending physicians, the professors. And more than once, I heard, well, she probably doesn't remember, and she had that spot before. No spot can happen in 12 hours. And when I heard that, I thought to myself, he's wrong and she's right. The patient is telling you they didn't have a red spot. The patient knows if they have a red spot on their arm. I would know. Most people know. And so, and they know they are ill. They know they have cancer that is spreading fast. And so I determined as a medical student to prove him wrong and to figure out if the cells really are capable of moving in 12 hours a distance, say, from a lymph node to the top of the skin. And it didn't take me too long. Once I had my own lab, we proved that within a year or two, that the patient had been right. And why was this important? Well, it was important because this is a cancer that is exactly characterized by its ability to move like crazy. It just moves through tissues, in clusters, in groups of cells. it has this capability that almost no other cancer has from its inception. Many cancers acquire those capabilities much later on in their progression. So I thought to myself, if we can figure out what gene determines or what set of genes determine this behavior, that should be a very important way to attack this cancer and many other cancers. And so eventually, that took a lot longer than a couple of years, but eventually we did clear out what were the essential motility genes that make this cancer so invasive and so successful in getting through tissues. It doesn't really proliferate. It doesn't divide any faster than other cancers, but it just moves, and it moves to places one doesn't want it to move.
And what is the mechanism?
So there is the main gene is a RAS homology protein, RHO. They are called RHO proteins, and it's a very interesting one. It's the type C, and so RhoC is a protein that is expressed during embryonic development for the cells to move, actually. It's activated during embryogenesis. Multiple tissues, the ovary, parts of the skin, the thyroid, activate RhoC to move to their correct location in the embryo. And then it's shut down. But of course, cancer finds a way to harness regular programs for its own advantage to overcome regulation by the normal tissues of the body. So the constant tension, right, between the normal tissues trying to get rid of the cancer and then the cancer trying to overcome that attack. And so cancers upregulate RhoC, even though it has no business being activated in adult tissues. It's an embryonic protein. And so that is a big discovery. The unfortunate part of it is we haven't yet figured out a way to drug it. We are still working on it. And so we haven't despaired. But I wish we were farther ahead on that by now.
Well, maybe that's one to watch. So mention metastasis, and the most common brain tumors are metastases from elsewhere, and breast is a common source for secondary deposits in the brain. Can you please tell our listeners a little about the groundbreaking work you and your team are doing to study the process of brain metastasis from breast cancer?
Great. Yeah, thank you for asking that, because similarly to what I just described for inflammatory breast cancer, I was told in medical school some very simple facts. The tumor is on one side on the bloodstream running around in the blood, and then all of a sudden you have a lesion inside the brain. And that didn't sit well with me, that we didn't understand almost anything, really, about how does it happen that, say, only 20% of breast cancers, which is a lot of people, right? This is not a small number, but it's only 20%. 80% don't go in the brain. And so how is this a thing? You know, how does this really happen? And so I too determined, I'm a pretty simplistic person, if you will. So, you know, I determined I want to see cancer cells go through a blood-brain barrier as alive. I want to see how they do it. I want to see how they move. I want to see how they push other cells, you know, aside, because we have a sanctuary site in the body. The brain is what we call a sanctuary site. It has a barrier. The separation between the bloodstream and the brain is very tight. As you can imagine, throughout evolution, we started eating a lot of stuff we probably shouldn't be eating, right? And so the people who didn't have a tight barrier died, and the ones who had a tighter barrier survived because some of the toxins didn't get in the brain. And so the brain is really, really designed to exclude all these wonderful drugs we have to kill tumors. And so brain metastases are very challenging, but it also excludes invasion from other cells. So we had no choice but to build a device that as closely as possible resembles the anatomy and the physiology of the normal barrier, because there was no other way to watch it happen. You could watch it in the mouse, perhaps, but it's still very difficult. And the mouse is the mouse. And so I just wanted all the human elements. So we constructed this device that allowed us to see the actual cancer cells for the first time ever. Cancer cells from people, not just cell lines that have been in labs for decades. We did that too. But then we had cells from actual brain metastases of humans that needed to have surgery. And we are the only ones who have been able to do this. But now I think a lot of people are very excited and more are using these devices. So I'm very happy that we are making some unexpected discoveries about how difficult it is for cancer cells to get in the brain. So we can explain now that 20%. But we really need to zero in now on all the factors that really promote that transition into the brain. We have some powerful ones, but I don't think we have the full story yet. So we're working very hard on that.
I'm trying to imagine recapitulating the blood-brain barrier, which, as you say, you know, yes, it's protected the species, but it's also made it harder for us to treat various neurological diseases, to get drugs to cross the blood-brain barrier. And I'm trying to imagine what your technology looks like. If I'd have been a smarter individual, I'd have looked it up. But I was involved years ago in the early stages of a company based in Charlottesville, Virginia, called Hemashare, that basically recapitulated the vascular endothelium and underlying layers and could look at how it reacted to changing pressures. So can you perhaps, for a simpleton like me, describe the technology and what insights you got about how, A, these pesky cells cross the blood-brain barrier, and possibly even more interesting, why in 80% they don't cross? Is that just because these patients succumb to other disease, or they don't live long enough to develop brain metastases?
Yeah, those are all great questions. Thank you for asking, Jonathan. So so first I'll answer the question of what are some of the steps that cancer cells, which are going to be successful, need to go through. So the cancer cells that are going to be successful, they have what we call brain tropism. That is, they will have an affinity to go through all the steps required. Start by sticking to the endothelial cells, to the beginning of the barrier. The barrier is not just one layer of cells. The endothelial cells are very important. But there are other cells on the brain side called pericytes that kind of impart some sort of order, if you will, to the monolayer, to the one layer of endothelial cells. So the cancer cells that are going to be successful first adhere, and then other cancer cells, maybe 10 or 20 others, usually cluster. That cluster is really dangerous because it adds probably some mediators, some of which we have identified, that then cause the endothelial cells to soften their junctions. So the junctions are not very good anymore. They are looser. And so that's the first thing that happens, that the endothelial cells separate from each other when there is a cluster of cancer cells on the circulation side adhering to it. Now, that makes already the barrier a little bit leaky. The next thing that happens is some of the mediators secreted by the cancer cells can now get into the brain side because the barrier is a little leaky. So once they are on the brain side, something incredibly surprising happens, and that is the astrocytes, which are really cells that support neurons. They are not really they don't have anything to do with breast cells. They see those mediators, and they begin to move in the direction of the cancer cells. So there is a remodeling of the brain tissue that begins to happen, and that exacerbates the breakdown of the membrane at that location. It's a small breakdown. It's right where the cells are sitting. And that's what begins the pathway for them to get inside. Now, the interesting thing is what happens next. The cells, the cancer cells, then approach the astrocytes. That interaction between the cancer cell and the astrocytes somehow switches the cancer cells into becoming, instead of motile agents, cells that move a lot, they switch and they become cells that proliferate a lot. And that is how the cancer really grows in the brains. It has to switch its characteristic. That plasticity is what really determines why some cells are able to make brain metastasis and others just don't succeed in all those steps. There are, you know, 6 or 7 steps required, we think, and some of them can get part of them, but they can't get all of them. So a small fraction of them can get all of them right, including that last switch. Because if you got 5 cancer cells in the brain that wanted to move around, you would never know they're there. But if those 5 cancer cells become 500 and 5,000 and 5 million, then it's a problem.
Yeah, sure, sure. That's fascinating. Slightly changing topic. But staying with malignancy, since I graduated from medical school, you know, when the characterization of malignancy was primarily predicated on evidence of spread to other organs and histologic appearance. But since then, there's been an explosion in our understanding of subtypes. Can you tell us about your interest in the aggressive phenotypes of breast cancer? You've mentioned inflammatory breast cancer, but can you dig into the aggressive phenotypes?
Yeah, so there are other aggressive phenotypes as well, like triple negative breast cancer in and of itself. Now, some inflammatory breast cancers can be triple negative, but they can also be ER positive. So inflammatory is its own sort of group. But triple negative breast cancer is another type of breast cancer we study. We also study breast cancers that amplify the HER2 receptor because they also tend to go to the brain. So those are the most aggressive forms of breast cancer that are much more common than inflammatory breast cancer that we study as well. In addition to that, certain populations get more aggressive cancers, like Black Americans and in Africans from West Africa, get very aggressive forms of triple negative breast cancer that have worse outcomes. And the reasons for that are not well understood at all.
Yeah, you know, again, I guess it's hard to unpack some of these things because, you know, I mentioned in my introduction global access and such like to care, and these can be very complicated issues. And having lived and worked in the United States for many years, there are disparities in care. And there are, I remember an African-American lady turning up with an ulcerating breast cancer, and it was just all about access, right? So I guess it's difficult to separate those. Anyway, another area where knowledge treatment has expanded is chemo prevention in breast cancer. Can you bring us up to speed on this, and please address how we deal with acceptance and barriers to the utilization of such chemo prevention? And again, for the benefit of those who are not medics, maybe just start at the beginning and take us through that.
Yes, thank you for that. You know, we have tried for decades in all cancers to see what can we give people without cancer who are at increased risk, who we know are at increased risk for the number of factors that they have, exposure, family history, any number of issues, any number of variables. What could we give them to decrease the incidence, to decrease the number of cancers in those populations? Is there something normal people, so-called, you know, people who don't have obvious cancer will take? Well, that is, you would think that's a no-brainer, right? I mean, you live in a society where if you're a woman born in America, you have a 12% chance of getting breast cancer. You would think it wouldn't be that difficult, especially if you could identify people who are a 40% chance of getting breast cancer, to suggest a drug. But and in spite of the highest level of evidence that we can obtain in clinical trials, namely double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trials that have proven that tamoxifen prevents breast cancer, and also very strong trials that show that certain aromatase inhibitors like exemestane also prevent breast cancer in high-risk populations, the uptake of these modalities in the United States across racial and ethnic boundaries is extremely low. It's under 20%, I believe, of the people who are eligible. And so it is, I have been a principal investigator of the whole region of the United States in some of these trials. I spent so much energy educating patients and, you know, administering the drugs safely. They are well tolerated, especially in postmenopausal women, but they are well tolerated in premenopausal women. Now I can say from personal experience, I had to take tamoxifen for my own treatment. I had to take aromatase inhibitors for my own treatment. So yeah, it is better to not take the drug, but it's a lot better than to not get the cancer. I would have taken the drug if I had known that was in my fate, but of course one doesn't know. So it's just a matter of evaluating risk, and that's why I created this clinic, to evaluate risk accurately, quantitatively, to bring the mathematics into the picture. In spite of that, it's been very difficult. But you know, this is the most important area, I think, that we really, the new frontier, is to really work on this better, because we worked on the science without working on the social science. We worked on the bench science without working on the social science. So it's the same reason why so many vaccine initiatives failed, even in amidst the pandemic, with refrigerated trucks pulling up to the docks of hospitals to get people in body bags into the refrigerated trucks. In spite of all that being seen on TV, we had a hard time getting people vaccinated, right? So we did the science perfectly. We didn't do the social science. So I think we should never make that mistake again in medicine in general, but in particular in cancer, because the same thing happened with chemo prevention. We do have tamoxifen, we do have exemestane. They do decrease the risk of breast cancer by half, and in at least in Western populations. And also, if you take a subset of people, for example, people who have a condition called atypical ductal hyperplasia, which means that the cells of the breast, say somebody's 50 or 60 years old, are completely confused about their hormonal signals. They think the host is pregnant, or they think the host is going to make milk for a baby. So all these things are wrong, right? The cells are not getting it right. And what tamoxifen does and exemestane does is quiets the signal inside those cells to get them to behave themselves and to stop proliferating when they shouldn't. So they are doing exactly what you want to do mechanistically. So really, there isn't any better science to explain. And in those people, the decrease in risk is 70%. When we have done the analysis, what we call the subset analysis of the clinical trials with thousands of people, when we take the people with atypical ductal hyperplasia or another condition called lobular carcinoma in situ, which is not a real cancer, it's just a flag of risk, those people's risk went down by 70% and they still don't take it. We don't have 100% uptake of this. We will never have 100%, but I would be happy with 60% instead of 10 or 20%. So unfortunately, Jonathan, this is at the intersection of how we communicate science to the public. So that's one of the reasons I'm happy to do this podcast and to hope to contribute one smidget to this quest. I think we need more social scientists involved in medicine. I think we need more multidisciplinary work into how to convey science to the public.
Yeah, you know, thank you for that very eloquent description, Sophia. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. But join us next week, please, for part two in this series, where we'll discuss precision medicine and AI in cancer treatments. For now, I'd like to thank Dr. Sophia Mariva for being with us today. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with you. So please, folks, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Check out our archives and tell everyone that you know that EMJ Podcast is the thing to listen to. And please join us next week for part two, as I've said. Until then, I'm Dr. Jonathan Sacchi. I thank you for listening. Please, everyone, stay safe, stay well, stay curious.